Brittany Griner may be the latest story of political imprisonment, but she's not alone. According to the James W. Foley Legacy Foundation, there are currently more than 50 Americans held captive in countries around the world, not by groups of terrorists or paramilitary groups, but in an increasing trend, they're held by foreign governments.
You have to deal with each one of these cases individually. You have to resolve them. And the political costs of not resolving them are usually higher than the costs of offering some kind of concession to bring Americans home.
That's Washington Post reporter Jason Rezaian. He knows the calculus all too well. In 2014, Rezaian and his wife Yegi were imprisoned by the Iranian government. Jason was held for 544 days.
In a number of these cases that we hear about in Iran and other authoritarian countries, 544 days is kind of the best case scenario.
Jason Rezaian is now on a mission to keep the same thing from happening to others. He says the U.S. government has to treat these situations with life and death urgency and less like diplomatic disputes. Rezaian has turned his story of being held hostage into a book and a podcast. When we spoke last year, he told us some of his story and why he thinks it's so essential the public, the media, and the U.S. government evolve the meaning of the word hostage. We're revisiting that interview this week because it may help us better understand what Brittany Griner is going through and how her case may be resolved.
I'm Jason Rezaian. I'm an opinions writer for The Washington Post. I started working for The Post the spring of 2012, and we got married in the spring of 2013.
And I'm Yegane Rezaian, the wife, and I work for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Jason, in 2009, you were freelance. Well, let's fast forward to July 2014. What happens?
I had just returned from covering a round of nuclear negotiations in Vienna. It was the first time that I'd been allowed to go and report from another country on an Iran story. It felt like I was making real progress in my work. Yegi and I had been married for just over a year. We were about to take a trip back to the Bay Area to pick up Yegi's green card. I mean, we had done all the paperwork from afar. Our lives were established now, and I finally felt at 38 years old that I had arrived at a place of stability and prosperity to a certain extent. And the future seemed extremely bright until we were arrested at gunpoint, leaving our apartment, going to a surprise birthday party on the night of July 22nd. And that changed our lives forever.
We locked up and headed downstairs in the elevator. When the doors opened in the parking garage, there were two guys standing there. One of them was pointing a gun right at me. Without even thinking, I reached into my pocket.
You were trying to take your phone out and those guys thought you have a gun. So they got physical with you.
That's a clip from Jason Rezaian's new podcast series, 544 Days. Yegi, what did that moment look like from your point of view? You were far more familiar with post-revolutionary Iran than your young husband.
Unfortunately, that's true. I think I always used to tell Jason that when you were born and you grew up in one of these authoritarian places, you always know of someone whose loved ones or a family member has been arrested, or you hear these stories on and off. It's like a familiar theme. So I still remember that when they raided our house, and within those first few minutes, I was trying to make sure that I get Jason's blood pressure medicine to him because I knew this is going to be a lengthy process. And he was trying to calm me down by saying, this is a mistake. Someone made a mistake. This is going to go away within a few minutes. They're going to find out that we haven't done anything. But in my mind, as much as I really appreciated him trying to calm me down by saying these things, I was like, no, Jason, this is not going to go away. This is not going to go away. No one has made a mistake. These guys are here to, they are going through our safe box with all of our passports, taking everything. And within a few minutes, 30 guys are in our house filming us. Some of them were ninjas, like wearing ninja clothing. Their face and everything is masked. Everyone wore surgical masks, although it's a long time before COVID. So I knew this is not going to go away anytime soon. And then they put us in a van, blindfolded us. They put handcuff on Jason. He was sitting in the row in front of me, and I was sitting in the back with a female guard. But she let us hold our hands, and I tried, because we got to our destination 5 minutes later. It's like that quick. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I lived for 30 years in a neighborhood that is only 5 minutes away from Evin prison. So this must be it. We are going there. And I tried to write on the palm of his hand, Evin, spell Evin. But obviously he was so stressed that I don't think he got it.
Well, I'm going to assume there's no Persian Miranda warning. Is there any obligation to tell you what they were charging you with, what they were looking for, what they thought you did? Nothing?
No, and I don't think that they had a concept of what they were going to charge us with until they had months to, you know, cobble a story together based on high-pressure interrogations, right? One of the other things that we had to relinquish that night was the passwords to our social media and email accounts. So they had access to our emails, and you know, they went about printing things out. My brother, as soon as he found out about this, and it was within 24 hours of our arrest that the Washington Post knew, because a colleague of ours went to our house, saw that, you know, it had been boarded up, contacted the Post. Post contacted my brother. My brother is a smart guy. He had the presence of mind to have our Gmail accounts. And because those accounts were no longer accessible, they had a very limited amount of emails to work with. Again, they use that as an accusation. Who is your brother? How come he's so important that he can get your key? I mean, in the vacuum of the Revolutionary Guard's interrogation process, anything is a crime. You know, I joke now that if you have a Gmail address and speak a second language, you too could be convicted of spying in Iran. And it really is that arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any obligation to tell anybody else? We don't have diplomatic relations with Iran. I assume there's an interest section. Who was handling an American who gets arrested in a country we don't have interests in?
The Swiss.
And
so that's the protecting power, has been since 1980. And they were, at the behest of the State Department, asking for access to me, as they do in every one of these cases. Iran's response is always the same. This person is not a dual national. They're an Iranian citizen. We don't recognize dual nationality. And so that's their way of keeping people outside of the prison and away from the person. My interrogators told me, the Swiss have come looking for you. We told them that you don't want to see them. I was like, you know, I'd like to have the opportunity to tell that to them myself. But, you know, this idea that Iran officially doesn't acknowledge dual nationality, it sounds really good. You know, former Foreign Minister Javad Zarif would come to the U.S. and make this pronouncement every time he was asked questions about me or other dual nationals who were held. But ultimately, we are an Iranian national until the day that they're ready to pull off a trade with the other country. And then all of that goes out the window, right? You know, I was traded as an American. I was held as an American. If it quacks like a duck, right?
The world, or your world, kicks into action. Your family is in harness. The Washington Post is in your corner. Officials in the Obama administration have your back as well. Do you have any awareness of what's going on?
No.
In the opening months, absolutely not. I mean, I was sealed off completely. for 49 days in solitary confinement. Yegi spent the entirety of her time in Evin in solitary confinement, 72 days. So we had no idea at that point. But after I came out of solitary and after Yegi was released, little bits and pieces of information would appear. You know, maybe a sympathetic guard would say something about a statement that had been made. Muhammad Ali had put out a statement on my birthday in 2015. That kind of was a turning point in that, you know, guards and interrogators started looking at me a little bit differently. Muhammad Ali isn't just an American hero. He's a Muslim hero, right? And so that was one example of that. You know, we had appeared on Anthony Bourdain's show, Parts Unknown, a few weeks before we were arrested. We were interviewed. I was praying that they would not decide to cut that segment from the show out of concerns for our safety, because I understood and believed to my core then and now that the farther and wider our names were known, the better off our chances were of getting out.
I remember on day 40-something, I was still in solitary. The woman next door to my cell found out who I was, like I was the wife of this American spy. And it was during Anga, so Iran's president, President Rouhani, and Foreign Minister Javad Zarif had a meeting with heads of press in New York City, and Marty Baron was there.
Marty Baron was executive editor of the Washington Post at the time.
So Marty asked a question from President Rouhani, and I'm sitting in my cell crying while the woman next door had a TV in her cell. So she raised the volume, and I heard the name Marty Baron, Washington Post, our correspondent, and his wife were in prison.
I would like to say to you personally that we believe that he deserves his freedom, and we ask the government of Iran to release him. And I want to ask you how the Iranian government can justify imprisoning a good journalist. I think you know he's a good journalist and a good person, and having him imprisoned.
So it's like there is something going on in the outside world, because before that they were telling us that it was reported in both domestic and international news that you guys were killed in a car accident, and that's it. No one's caring anymore. And you, when you are in a hole like that in solitary, you believe it. You're like, fine, probably that's very true, because no one is knocking the door asking for me, because you don't know what is happening outside. I always tell people that solitary is like a grave. You are alive, but they put you in a grave while you're still alive. But it was very interesting to hear that few seconds of that interview, because I kept saying, oh God, why is Washington Post not doing anything for my husband? So it was really reassuring listening to that, hearing that.
Is there an evolution of what the Iranians say you've been arrested for? Do we finally get some sort of straight story? Or is this a constantly moving target through these months and months of confinement?
Well, initially, you know, those first few months, they are saying that we're doing an investigation, right? We're investigating complaints about what this person was up to under the guise of being a journalist. And as time went on, it became clearer and clearer that they were going to charge me with crimes against Iran's national security, including spying for the U.S. government, conspiring with an enemy state, the U.S. government. For a time, they were saying that I was conspiring with Israel, which carries a death sentence with it, propaganda against the regime, insulting the supreme leader. I mean, there was a long list of charges. Some of them were dropped before my trial. But ultimately, when we talk about charges in these cases, and, you know, I talk about this in the context of my case, but also, for example, in the case of Danny Fenster, the journalist who was in Myanmar, we shouldn't rehash and repeat all of the charges, because the charges are almost always completely bogus, right? Rather than having a headline of Washington Post journalist accused of spying or convicted of spying in Iran, it should be Washington Post journalist being held hostage on bogus charges, right? And I will keep fanning the flames on that conversation until we turn the tide on that and colleagues in the media realize that there's a better way to report on these stories.
In your podcast series, 544 Days, we hear from the many people in this hastily assembled orbit of interests. There's your mother, Mary.
Jason loves Iran. He would never do anything to hurt Iran, to bring shame to Iran. It is my intention to come to Iran.
Your brother, Ali.
Yeah, I mean, I think for the first fair bit, we were like, all right, you know, Jason's been brought in to talk before. We didn't know the extent of what had happened at your house.
Marty Baron, who not only is an editor who has to look out for his people, but is also defending broader principles about our business and what it exists for and what it exists to do and why you should be protected.
We didn't want to be so belligerent that the Iranians would just say, you know, they're not going to do anything and they're offended by what we were saying. But over time, you know, it became clear that we should be even more and more forceful.
And members of a Washington administration trying to negotiate a treaty with the Iranians at the same time as they're trying to win your release.
And the last thing in the world we wanted was to see you pass away under those circumstances. And believe me, we kept making that point to the Iranians that if that did happen, everything was going to go to hell in the handbasket.
Their stories are fascinating because you don't know about any of this. So we hear your reflections, and in simultaneously, there's this world of activity going on from these different points of view. Did you get to, in effect, recontextualize, re-experience, re-understand what this was all about? Because you, in effect, weren't there for it for the first time when it first happened.
So, yes. And, you know, when I was released, I had a lot of ideas, a lot of anger, frustrations about what the government especially was and wasn't doing, what the Post, you know, I needed to understand when they got involved, right? What my brother and my mom were doing in those earliest days. And I say that in the first episode, you know, if you have a loved one that gets locked up on the other side of the world, listen up. I mean, you know, they're going to get out one day and they're going to want to know what you did for them, right? I mean, that's just the God's honest truth.
There was one goal. I mean, I guess that was made it really kind of easy. If you step back and say, I don't have to pay attention to any of this other stuff, right? There's one thing that's going on here.
My brother, Ali, was, I think, a really important piece of the pre-Jason puzzle. He had never had experience doing this kind of advocacy on any issue, but recognized really quickly that to win my release, he was going to need help, and he was going to need help from important people.
So when you think about somebody and you think about these people as people, right? They've got a family, they've got kids. Now, maybe they think that they're hot. I'm not talking about anybody in particular, right? And you're just like, eh, they're a person. They've got power that I need to be able to get them to use on my behalf. And that's the way I went about it.
And I think those efforts started slowly with a group of Iranian expats, journalists, human rights advocates who were advising him. And when he didn't see any positive action in our case come out of that, he started on pounding on doors in Washington and was able to get himself in front of some very, very important figures within the Obama administration. My mom, when I was arrested, she was told not to go to Iran, that it was unsafe for her. And I think she listened to that advice for several months. But when things weren't working out and I was being held longer and longer and longer, she finally threw caution to the wind, stepped on a plane and flew to Tehran, where she began agitating and advocating wherever she could.
The experience of doing that felt strange. You know, I've always tended to be somewhat of a private person, and yet
this was a matter of life and death. And so I had to reach in to find other rusty parts of myself to do my share.
And that included, you know, showing up at government offices, showing up at the Revolutionary Court, talking to the judge many times, trying to get him to release me on bail, trying to convince them to give me better living conditions while I was in jail, and even showing up at events and holding signs. I mean, this is not something that anybody in Iran does.
So we were ushered into this building with cameras on the outside, and there were a couple of guys, and one of them said to me in English, "We saw you on TV. We saw you on BBC. Why did you go there?" And I said, "Because this is taking too long. My son is innocent, and I want to see him." And we had a back and forth, and I'm pounding on the table, and I'm looking him straight in the eye, which I know Iranian women of my age would not do. So I wasn't playing the part that they expected me to play.
During the nuclear negotiations in 2014, Obama administration's officials decided to open up a channel of negotiations over the freedom of myself and several other Americans who were being held in Iran. And Secretary of State John Kerry and Wendy Sherman, who was the lead nuclear negotiator, tasked Brett McGurk, who at the time was President Obama's special envoy in the fight against ISIS, to lead the negotiations over a prisoner swap. Those were done separate from the nuclear negotiations in different locations secretly, and they went on for about 14 months. Brett McGurk is someone who at the time had a really important political portfolio that he was dealing with. And so, you know, adding secret negotiations to his to-do list was not something that he initially wanted to take on. But because it was a direct order, as he says, he did it willingly and with a lot of flair and success, ultimately.
The Iranians wanted this massive trade of much more people that they considered that we were holding unjustly, which of course we weren't. And we, based on their own principle of reciprocity, we had kind of culled down to seven people held in American prisons or who were on parole, who were like about to get out anyway, kind of what we considered almost freebies.
He is one of the people in the podcast who I interview, who I've gotten to know and really formed a relationship with since my release. And we had pretty incredible access to meet a lot of those folks in the administration and unwind, unspool a lot of this story and find out what actually happened, what was being said, who did what.
Yegi Rezaian is a journalist who works for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jason Rezaian is a global opinions writer for The Washington Post. He was the paper's correspondent in Tehran before he was arrested and held in an Iranian prison for 18 months. He wrote about that experience in his 2019 book, Prisoner. And in his new podcast, 544 Days, Jason tells the backstory of the campaign and the people who fought for his release. You can listen to that on Spotify. Thank you both.
Thank you.
You've been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there other international stories you'd like us to cover? Please send an email or a voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Ryan Housel and Andrew Stelzer. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. Research and fact-checking was provided by our associate producer, Ryan Housel. Additional production and engineering provided by Rob Spate. Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.